In the Moment is supported by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting the South Dakota Festival of Books, September 26th to 28th in Spearfish.
South Dakotans have deep roots, but sometimes those roots burrow into the earth of other places at the same time. From SDPB, this is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we talk with author Patrick Hicks. After years of international travel and living abroad, Hicks found himself rethinking what it means to belong. Hicks teaches at Augustana University in Sioux Falls. He's lived in South Dakota longer than anywhere else. And yet, when he found himself longing for home, he pointed his car east to travel the vast shorelines of Minnesota, the place of his childhood. His new book is called Greater Minnesota, Exploring the Land of Sky Blue Waters. We'll talk with Hicks about the Museum of Spam, the Great Minnesota Get-Together, and why Minnesota nice sometimes isn't nice at all. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're In the Moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Patrick Hicks is one of South Dakota's most well-known contemporary writers. He's written three novels of the Holocaust, most recently Across the Lake. He also penned a collection of short stories, The Collector of Names, and multiple poetry collections, including Adoptable and Library of the Mind. His latest book comes as something of a departure. After years of international travel and years of teaching at South Dakota's Augustana University in Sioux Falls, Hicks turns his literary attention to his home state of Minnesota. Now, he admits Minnesota can feel like another country at times, so why not ride its back roads and highways as a traveler, seeking understanding and connection and identity in a place both familiar and foreign? The result is the travelogue Greater Minnesota, Exploring the Land of Sky Blue Waters. In the book, Hicks wanders the streets of his Stillwater home and visits the sites of various known and lesser-known Minnesota landmarks. To travel with Patrick Hicks is to drive the North Shore, meditate among the brutalist architecture of St. John's, pop by the Spam Museum, feast at the Great Minnesota Get-Together, and contemplate the atrocities of history in Mankato. Patrick Hicks joined me for a reading and conversation. We'll begin here with an excerpt of Greater Minnesota.
From the Land of Sky Blue Waters. The popular song, From the Land of Sky Blue Water, by Charles Wakefield Cadman, became something of a national sensation when it appeared in 1909, and it has since become the unofficial nickname of my home state. Other unofficial monikers include Land of 10,000 Lakes and the Gopher State. The official state motto? That would be L'Étoile du Nord, the Star of the North, or the North Star State. The name Minnesota is derived from the Dakota phrase Minnesota Makoche, which means land where the waters are so clear they reflect the clouds. This is a perfect description because the sky is, indeed, beautifully reflected in the bountiful waters of the state, especially when you're lazing in a canoe. And goodness knows there's no shortage of lakes in the Land of Sky Blue Waters. In fact, there are so many lakes that Minnesota actually has more shoreline than California, Hawaii, and Florida combined. When I was a kid, I didn't concern myself with any of this. If I heard the phrase, from the Land of Sky Blue Water, I'd think about a jingle for Ham's Beer that aired on television. If you're of a certain vintage, you're probably hearing that ad in your head now. To be honest, when I was growing up, I didn't think much about what it meant to be a Minnesotan. Hearing certain words did, however, conjure up the state's silhouette in my imagination. Words like hot dish, lake time, WCCO, and Duluth. In other words, I was only vaguely aware of the larger state beyond me. Also, the crucial element of Minnesotan-ness that made a kid popular was totally lost on me. I was lousy at hockey, you see, and if you didn't skate well, there was zero chance of being cool. My family also didn't go fishing, we didn't have a snowmobile, and we didn't own a cabin in the woods. On top of this, my mother is an immigrant from Northern Ireland. This meant I was more interested in her side of the family, especially since Belfast was in the news a lot during the 1970s and 80s. It was the height of the Troubles, and we got weekly phone calls from aunts and uncles about what was happening. Cars were exploding, military helicopters thumped the night, The British Army patrolled streets in full battle gear. My relatives spoke in the rapid sing-song of the Northern Irish accent. They said certain words that conjured up a torn land, words like terrorism, IRA, UVF, tear gas, and bomb. I may have been raised in Minnesota, but my imagination was pulled across the Atlantic. That's what this book is about. After traveling internationally for so many years, I thought it was time, long past time, to explore the back roads and far corners of my home state. This book is part travelogue, part history book, and part discovery of new places. What makes the North Shore, the Iron Range, and all those lakes so quintessentially Minnesotan? In many ways, this book is an excuse to visit places I've heard about my life, all my life, and it also offers me a chance to consider my state's identity. After poking around Europe for so long and asking questions about place, it was time to do the same for Greater Minnesota. What was waiting to be discovered? What does it mean to be a Minnesotan? So, let's begin.
I took this book to a lake in Minnesota this weekend to read it because I thought that was the appropriate. I left the state to read to read this book. I want to go back to the origin of it.
Yeah.
And start really with where you're from and the places that you've traveled, because I think that's essential for people, especially if they're new to your work.
Oh yeah.
To understand where you're, where you were born, where you were raised, and where you have lived.
Yeah, sure. I was I was born in, and this is a surprise, I think, to people that know me. I was born in Charlotte, North Carolina, and we moved when I was two, so I have no memories of that at all.
Yeah.
So I can't say I was born in Stillwater, Minnesota, but I was certainly raised in Stillwater, Minnesota. And Stillwater, I couldn't wait to leave Stillwater when I was a teenager because I thought the world was beyond this lazy little river town. But Stillwater is just a beautiful, beautiful town. It's on the National Historic Registry, and it's called the birthplace of Minnesota because it was in Stillwater in 1848 that a group of men got together, and they wanted to be a part of the federal government. Wisconsin had become a state, and Minnesota was kind of rudderless as far as it came to having an affiliation with the federal government in Washington, D.C. So the Minnesota Convention happened. And a man named Sibley, who would later become the governor, went to Washington, and ultimately Minnesota became a state. And Minnesota territory stretched all the way to the Missouri River. Mm. So if things had worked out a little bit differently, I would be speaking to you from Sioux Falls, Minnesota.
When did you leave Minnesota, and where did you go?
Yeah. I went to university at St. John's University. It's in central Minnesota, and I've got a chapter on that. And after I graduated, I really wanted a big American city experience, so I moved to Chicago for 2 years. And while I was in Chicago, I found out that I was able to become an Irish citizen because my mother's an immigrant from Northern Ireland. And I got the passport really on a whim. I thought it might be kind of a cool thing to say at parties, you know, hey, did you know I'm an Irish citizen? But when the passport arrived in the mail, I still remember holding it. I was looking at it. It was purple. It had the Irish harp on the front, and it said European Union at the top. And I opened it up, and there next to my name and my my face was Irish citizen, and in English and in Irish. And it was at that moment that I realized that I could move to Europe, and that's what I did a few months later.
So growing up with your mother in the house, this is during the Troubles, and you're connected to, you know, you kind of mentioned Stillwater being a sleepy town. Part of the reason that was the case for you was because in the confines or the comforts of your home was this international thing that people were paying attention to, but you were, your family's paying attention to it in a really intense way. What was that like for you?
Yeah, it was, you know, I was a kid, and like most other teenagers, I'm just was just self-absorbed. So it was in the background, but I was always aware that bombs were going off in Belfast. And my family over there wasn't in immediate danger. I mean, a car bomb could go off, yes, of course, but they were not living in Belfast. One of them was living in Carrickfergus, which had some sectarian tension, still does to this day. So I was, my imagination was pulled across the Atlantic. You know, my father's family history is deep and rich and interesting, but compared to what was happening in Northern Ireland, I just, I started to care about Northern Ireland a lot when I was 16 because my mom took me to Northern Ireland to meet my relatives. And that was a seismic wake-up to my imagination.
Yeah. Tell me about going there and meeting relatives and understanding something that you didn't understand before.
Yeah. Well, just being surrounded by people that had the Northern Irish accent was, you know, and it was like, oh, I'm a foreigner here. And seeing the military helicopters, hearing them at night, and they don't have the running, or they didn't have the running lights on, so you'd hear, but you couldn't see the helicopter. Maybe a shaft of light would come shooting out of the sky, and they might follow a car or something like that. British Army in full battle gear. These were all sights which were very sort of surprising to me. Mm-hmm. And it was really wonderful meeting these relatives that I'd heard of all of my life, but I hadn't met. And they just welcomed me. I remember one of my, she's not a relative, but she was a close family friend. I was in her house and she'd given me tea and she looked at me and she was older. She said, "Ah, Patrick, I think you're the first Catholic to be in my house," which I laughed at, but I don't think she was joking.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And you made it out.
Yeah.
So, you finally, you know, you get your citizenship when you're 20, you said?
About 22, 23.
Yeah. And then you get on a plane.
Yeah. Moved to Northern Ireland and went to Queen's University Belfast, and I was there during the Troubles. It's very interesting living with political violence, because you're getting on with your life. You got to get groceries, got to get a haircut, want to go out to the pub with your friends, but yet you know that there's this violence that's swirling around you, and there's sort of an ominous feeling. I've felt this shell forming over myself just for protection, you know?
Yeah.
So I was in Northern Ireland for a year, and then I moved to other parts of Europe.
Yeah. So what are you studying during that year in Northern Ireland?
Yeah. I'm studying Northern Irish literature, and not just Northern Irish, because we did read writers from the Republic, from the South, but that's what I was studying. I have to admit, I wasn't a very good student at Queen's, because I remember being in the library, and I loved the work that I was reading, but I remember clearly being in the library, and I watched a Land Rover go by. These are these hulking gray machines that the police use with the blast shields and everything, and I can hear the military helicopter in the distance, and I remember looking out and saying to myself, my education is out there, it's not in here. So I kind of made a choice to not be as good of a student, but I walked around Belfast fearlessly and would talk to anyone that would talk to me just so I could try to understand both sides.
Were you writing at that time? Were you? Yeah. Did you have a notebook with you?
Yeah, I was writing. My first novel, The Commandant of Lubezetch, is my first novel as far as the public is concerned,
sure.
But it's really like my sixth. So, yeah, I wrote at least one failed novel in Northern Ireland.
Yeah. Yeah. So you move on to?
I go to Germany for a year. I teach English as a foreign language there. I moved to a town called Kiel, which is where the German Navy is based. And Kiel got flattened during the war because the German Navy was based there. And then I moved to England to work on my PhD, a town called Brighton, which is just an hour south of London. And then I moved to Barcelona for a year, and I really wanted to come home. I missed the Midwest. And the opening chapter, I talk about that. Mm-hmm. There's something about the Midwest that I'm a Midwestern boy. You know, I might have been in Europe, but I'd always called myself a Minnesotan.
Yeah. So let's come home to Minnesota
yeah.
for you. Or you come home to South Dakota. When do you start teaching at Augustana?
I started in fall of 2002.
Okay.
Yeah, and I love Augustana. I feel so lucky to teach at Augustana, to work with the colleagues that I do, to teach the students that I do. And although I've lived in South Dakota longer than I've lived anywhere else, if you ask me what I am or where I'm from, I always say Minnesota. I have sort of this stubborn refusal to let go of the place that formed me so deeply at a young age.
Well, I think sometimes people who are from South Dakota and have been here their whole life will sort of, you know, point that out to you as well. So there's something about being from a place, like where are you from is a complicated question.
Yeah, it is.
And I feel like in South Dakota, particularly, like your roots have to go pretty deep.
Yeah.
You know, before you can say you're from South Dakota.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Obviously, I am at this point. I mean,
right.
My whole professional life is South Dakota.
So, and all this background for listeners, although it's also interesting, is to bring us to this idea of you come at the book Greater Minnesota as a traveler.
Yeah.
In your own home state.
Yeah.
After traveling Europe, after living across the border in South Dakota, you decide to go home where you feel like you're from, where you grew up, where you went to college, so
yep.
You're home, but as a newcomer.
Yeah.
Tell me about how this book got its start in your mind or as a project.
I have been working on the Holocaust, researching the Holocaust for over 15 years now. I've written 3 books. I've gone to 12 concentration camps, interviewed survivors, read I don't know how many books, and I realized that I needed to step back just for my own mental health. I mean, you can only surround yourself with something like that for so long before at least I felt I just really need to step back. I promised myself I'll keep teaching and lecturing on it, but I just don't think I can write another book on it. But I didn't know what the next book would be.
Mm-hmm.
And then my friend John Lauk approached me with this idea. He's like, you should write a book on Minnesota. And I kind of like, I don't know if I want to do that. We went out for beer, and which is always a good creative lubricant. And it became, I started to think about, well, what would that book look like? And I thought, well, if I acted like a foreigner in my home state, and I went to places I'd heard about all my life, but I'd never seen, I said, that could be a pretty interesting book. And I can do something as a writer that I haven't been able to do with the Holocaust, is I can be funny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can have fun and be funny.
Yes. It was a joy to write this book. It was just such a soul cleanser for me.
Yeah. And looking at your own state with fresh eyes or as a traveler was also interesting because, as you say in the book, you didn't grow up owning a cabin.
Nope.
You skate like a Bambi.
Yes.
Which is to say not well.
Yeah.
You didn't really go fishing or
nope.
snowmobiling.
Nope.
You didn't care for Prairie Home Companion.
Sorry, Carison.
You're not even a real fan of Bob Dylan, which at that point I think maybe you're just being difficult. But the the idea is that you are from Minnesota, but because of who you are and who your family is,
yeah.
There was a sense of otherness about you even in your home state, that you didn't have some of the trappings that many, many people, you know, didn't have.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Did you feel that? Did you feel like an outsider growing up in your own home state, or were you not that aware?
Oh, what a great question. As a teenager, I don't think I was aware enough.
Yeah.
You know, I was interested in other things. But writing this book made me really question my relationship with Minnesota and mm-hmm. why do I love the place so much?
Yeah.
And honestly, Lori, I can see myself writing another book similar to this. Down the road.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In South Dakota?
More Minnesota.
Minnesota. Because obviously there's lots of places to go.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so you decided Greater Minnesota, you know, staying away from the Mall of America or some of the...
Yeah. Yeah.
Or a Vikings game or a Twins game to travel the state because
yeah.
why?
Well, I knew the Twin Cities really well.
It's, yeah.
I grew up in Stillwater, and I knew the Twin Cities really, really well. And I knew St. John's well, which is right in the center of the state. But the rest of the state, I didn't know much about it. You know,
yeah.
I knew the geography, and I was, like, aware of what was happening. I knew that Embarrass, Minnesota usually gets the coldest temperatures. International Falls, I was kind of interested to see that. The North Shore, I've been to the North Shore a couple of times before I wrote Greater Minnesota, but it was obvious to me that the state that I thought I knew was really just the Twin Cities.
Yeah.
And writing this book allowed me to embrace the rest of it. So while I was at St. John's, there were a number of people that helped me with the different parts that appear in the chapter, and Dr. Matt Heinzelman was one of them. He's one of the curators and specialists at Himmel, which is the largest digital library in the world, and noble purpose of taking photos of religious iconography. I went to Himmel. While I was at St. John's, I walked by Himmel all the time, but I'd never actually been inside. So I wanted to get inside, and fortunately, Matt opened the doors. He nodded. "Would you like to see some of the more peculiar things we have?" "Absolutely. I like peculiar." So I followed him out of the vault, past the digital studio, and into a narrow room that had a library shelf on one side and metal shelving bolted to the other wall. We walked past rows of Bibles from the 1600s. Some were intricate and fine, while others had no decoration at all. Over the centuries, how many people had touched these Bibles? What churches and homes and steamships had they been on? Matt stopped next to the shelving and pulled out a cardboard box. He opened it to reveal a smaller black box, which was opened delicately. "This is the oldest object we have." It was papyrus from the 5th century. It was protected between two plates of glass, and there was a certificate of authenticity from the Egyptian government. It was light brown and the size of two business cards. "It's written in Coptic," Matt said, bringing it toward me. I thought about the hand that had written it 4 centuries after the crucifixion of Christ. Given that it was Coptic, and the Copts were some of the earliest Christians, whoever wrote this was almost certainly a believer. "What's it say?" I asked. "It's a fragment, so we don't really know. I imagined it being in Egypt at roughly the same time that Benedict of Nursia was establishing his first monastery at Monte Cassino. Was it a holy document, a bill of sale? I imagined it being rolled up and stored somewhere, forgotten, and then passed down through the generations, hand to hand, a secret history, moving from city to foreign city, until, finally, it found its way to Collegeville, Minnesota, where it will stay until it finds a new temporary owner. With something this old, you don't really own it. You become a part of its history." Matt replaced it in the small black box. He refolded the certificate and closed it up. He went back into the cardboard box that it was shelved. I wondered who would see it again. Would Matt show it to someone else in a few years, or would it stay in the dark for months, maybe years, before it was pulled out once again into the light? As I was thinking about this, Matt reached for another cardboard box. We call this the Smoky Book. It was deep brown, almost black. The cover had no words, and there was a leather string to tie it shut. "It's a Psalter from Ethiopia. We think it's about 300 years old." Psalters contain the Book of Psalms, as well as a liturgical calendar and the lives of saints. They're used by individuals for prayer and contemplation. Matt explained that this particular Psalter must have been read by candlelight for decades. "Take a smell," he said, lifting it to my nose. I took a deep breath. It was amazing. It smelled exactly like a campfire. I took a long sniff and tried to imagine how many candles needed to burn in order for smoke to be absorbed by the pages. "That's why we call it the Smoky Book," he said, turning it over. I stepped back and considered that the name Smoky Psalter would be a way better name. Plus, it's fun to say, Smoky Psalter. I thought about telling Matt this, but he was already wrapping it up and returning it to the shelf.
So tell me a little bit about how you hit the road. It's you at a budget motel of some kind, or a chain hotel, I guess, maybe not budget hotel, but and a notebook in your car.
No, I listened to a number of podcasts, and I had a journal next to me.
Yeah.
So, while I'm driving, if a thought comes to me, I'd put the journal on my knees and scribble very quickly, because these were rural roads. I mean, often I didn't even see anyone else.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about some of the places that you went. And let's start just over the South Dakota border in the southwest. You know, Pipestone, Mankato, which many people who travel from South Dakota to Minneapolis might go through Pipestone or Mankato and might know very little bit about it. You get out of the car and you look around.
Yeah, I went to Pipestone shortly after I moved to South Dakota because I'd heard that it was very important to the Native community. And I thought, well, if I'm moving to South Dakota, I want to learn who my neighbors are. So I went to Pipestone, and I was really captivated by the place and the idea of, quarrying down for that special rock so that you can make pipes, hence the name Pipestone. So that was really interesting. And the Jeffers petroglyphs are very close to Pipestone. And I knew hardly anything about the Jeffers petroglyphs. They're 7,000 years old. It's the oldest recorded human history we have in Minnesota, if not perhaps the Midwest, if not perhaps the United States.
Yeah, the first time that people are storing knowledge there. Tell us about Jeffers.
Yeah. So the Jeffers petroglyphs are
the oldest site of recorded knowledge.
Yeah.
It says in the book.
Yeah. Whew. Yeah. It's really impressive to stand there and to see these ancient chiseled art that is telling a story. It's like an encyclopedia. It's like a cathedral. And the man, the guide that took me through the Jeffers petroglyphs, his name was Chuck. He just really helped me understand. And it is clear spending time with him that he's really, not only does he know what he's talking about, he's really passionate about what he talks about. Mm. But to stand in front of the Jeffers petroglyphs is to realize woolly mammoths were still roaming around. And these are 3,000 years older than the pyramids on the Giza Plateau. It is humbling.
And you can't take a photograph of them?
No.
Because?
They are spiritual creatures, so you're not allowed to take photos.
Tell me a little bit about the ongoing work, because this is also a living history site. More knowledge is being added? Or what are the indigenous, what are the tribes doing today?
Yeah. this is, I guess, not surprising, but it wasn't until maybe 20 years ago, maybe 30 years ago, that the people that run the Jeffers Petroglyphs, which is the Minnesota Historical Society, got the idea that maybe we should have Lakota, Dakota, Ojibwe leaders come here and tell us what they're seeing.
Hmm. Novel
idea. Seems like, why didn't you do that a long time ago?
Yeah.
And of course, they learned an awful lot just because of the oral history and there's a mother-like figure in the Jeffers petroglyphs, and one of the elders, I think a Dakota elder, said that's probably the oldest one because it's Mother Earth. Mm-hmm. And that it was kind of a revelation for a number of people.
Yeah. So as you're traveling, tell me a little bit about what you're, because you're not going as a tourist, you're going as a traveler, but yet you're also writing about it, but yet it's also somewhat familiar. I mean, like, you know where to get food, you know where you're going to stay at night, you can call home to your wife and son, you're in touch with the world, but yet you're also trying to see it as, how do you create, what I'm wondering is, like, how do you create the mental space and the creative space?
Oh, yeah.
To be among the very familiar and yet see it new.
I went to a hockey game near Eveleth, a high school hockey game, and I'm not a sports guy, so I went with my journal, and it was a wonderful experience. It was, you know, the space was like, it looked professional to me. I mean, this is hockey in northern Minnesota. It's like semi-pro already because these kids are so good. And to be in that space and to watch the community interact with each other, I felt like I was the only person that didn't know someone there. There was just so much warmth and kindness, and I sat on both sides, and man, those kids know how to play hockey. I couldn't help but watch this hockey game and realize I'm looking at future NHL stars right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so then you go back home and you say, how do I write about that?
Yeah.
That's what I'm trying to get at.
Oh, I understand. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's all the notes that I take. I still have my notebooks, and I take tons and tons and tons of notes. How something sounds, what something looks like, what something I'm sort of feeling. So this is how I come back. And I should say that I do I think of it as field research, like going to the hockey game or going to the U.S. Hockey Hall of Fame. I do that, and then I come back to the hotel, and I open up my computer, and I start to transcribe my notes, and often full sentences will come out.
Sure.
And if I've talked to someone, because I had wonderful guides that took me around the Mayo Clinic, for example, and the Hibbing Historical Society, many different guides at St. John's University helped me, I would write out what they told me in quotation marks, and I would immediately put that into a file so that I could capture, and I didn't have to rely on my memory.
Yeah. How often were you telling people, even strangers, like, I'm the guy with the notebook. Yeah, I'm writing a book about Minnesota.
There are places you go, and if you're writing in a notebook, people look at you like you're a weirdo. The Spam Museum is definitely one of those places.
not many people bring their notebooks to the Spam Museum? Is that what you're telling
me? That's exactly what I'm telling you. Yeah, I got some looks from people. I was at Grand Portage in extreme northern Minnesota. We're talking like only 10 minutes from the Canadian border. And Grand Portage was a wonderful experience talking about the fur trade and how important Grand Portage was about 300 years ago. And there are live reenactors, and a lady with a skirt came up to me, and she looked at my notebook and nodded and said, you're taking this more seriously than the average visitor. So
I don't might be said of you in the Spam Museum as well,
yeah,
taking it more seriously than the average visitor.
Yes, yeah. There was a docent, sort of a wandering, a spam ambassador is what they're called. They wander around
and
answer questions.
As one would, yeah.
Yeah, and I asked that spam ambassador a ton of questions.
Yeah. You say in the end, you don't tell this story in the book, but there in the notes section, you meet the one person in Minnesota who's not nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. You met somebody who's a jerk. We'll go unnamed here on public radio.
Yeah. You know, I
just love that.
They had as much conversational charm as an alarm clock. They were just a pill.
So tell me about Minnesota nice then, because almost everybody was the opposite.
Yeah.
Minnesota nice, which you unpack and say Minnesota nice also can be passive aggressive, also can be unwilling to look at the reality of your own history.
Yes.
What is Minnesota nice?
Yeah. Minnesota nice is that sense of being reserved, being polite, not asking too many questions, which is part of the problem with Minnesota nice, because it's a way to not talk about uncomfortable things.
Yeah.
And there are uncomfortable things that we do need to talk about, the different sort of minorities that we have in Minnesota, for example. It's being Minnesota nice is a way to sort of detach and shut down. So I see it as two sides of the coin. Yes, there's something nice about Minnesota nice, but there's also something a little evasive about it.
Mm. Yeah. So, for example, when you go to Mankato, the story of Mankato is the story of the Dakota 38.
Yeah.
Plus,
the largest mass execution in United States history, and it was President Lincoln that authorized that. And I'd driven through Mankato so many times, and I had only heard about the U.S. Dakota War maybe 15 years ago. Mm. You know, I'm in my 50s. That's like pretty shocking that I didn't know about it. So I thought, well, if I'm writing a book about Minnesota, I can't write about just the nice things. I need to look squarely and honestly at our history and what happened to those Dakota men and what happened to many of the white settlers around Mankato is it's horrifying. And it's definitely a part of Minnesota history. And it to write a book like this, I just wouldn't feel right if I didn't include it.
Yeah. I want to pivot to the Spam Museum, which sounds like a hard pivot, but there's also an underlying, you know, story of war and feeding troops with spam, which I was not aware of. So tell us a little bit about how spam became so iconic.
Yeah. I didn't know this until I started reading books about spam. And there are several books about spam out there. But spam came about in the 1930s, and it was helpful during the Depression because it was cheap, it was shelf-stable, and of course when World War II started, it was a fantastic way to feed the troops because you didn't need to refrigerate it. It was relatively light. You could put it over
protein.
You could put it over a campfire, for example, and the U.S. troops ate a lot of spam. but not just the U.S. troops. So did the British troops and, a touch surprisingly to me, the Soviet Army.
Yeah.
Nikita Khrushchev said that they wouldn't have been able to defeat the Nazis without spam.
Defeat the Nazis.
Yeah.
Sound like you said to feed the Nazis.
Oh, man.
Defeat.
As far as I know,
they fed the Allies to defeat the Nazis. And that was nothing that had come up. You're a World War II scholar.
Yeah, I was.
And the first time you learned that story was in the Spam Museum or in a book about
it was
spam?
It was in a book because they quoted Nikita Khrushchev, and I thought, wow, how did I not know that? And wow, that makes sense. And yeah, and spam, the plant of spam, all the men were off fighting war, so it was all these women that were doing all of the work for spam, and they had a big fence around it and, you know, lights, and it was a protected site.
Yeah, Rosie the Riveter came to...
Rosie the Riveter, and I invented the idea of Susie the Spam Maker. But the highlight of the Spam Museum was tucked away in a corner. It almost felt like a shrine. I walked over, already smiling. It was a replica set of the Monty Python sketch that aired on December 15, 1970. A screen showed it on continuous loop. Written by Terry Jones and Michael Palin, this beloved skit is a perfect example of surrealist humor, A married couple, Mr. and Mrs. Bunn, levitate down via wires into a diner called the Green Midget Cafe. They find themselves surrounded by Vikings, and almost everything on the menu has Spam in it, much to the disgust of Mrs. Ben, played by Graham Chapman. When Mr. Bunn, Eric Idle, asks for a full list of offerings, the waitress, Terry Jones, lists off items ranging from egg bacon and Spam to lobster thermidor with a fried egg on top and Spam. Shortly after this, the Vikings start to sing with gusto about their love for Spam. The whole thing is absolutely hilarious. A classic. While it's probably accidental that the Pythons had Vikings in the background, the very mascot of Minnesota's professional football team, it may not be. After all, one of the Pythons, Terry Gilliam, was born in Minneapolis and spent part of his childhood in the suburb of Medicine Lake. He might very well have made a connection between where Spam was created, and maybe, perhaps, possibly, he suggested Vikings as a kind of homage to Minnesota. Or maybe not. It could just be that the Pythons liked the idea of Vikings singing about meat. This thought bugged me for several days, so I decided to approach Terry Gilliam. Maybe he'd give me a sentence or two for this book. Maybe he could clear things up about the singing Vikings and any ties to Minnesota. After a search on the internet, I reached out to his agent in the hopes of getting an answer. His agent in England politely emailed back, "I'm sorry, but Terry isn't able to respond to questions. He gets so many, I'm afraid he has to de facto decline these days." Fair enough. He must get a lot of Spam.
Were there places that you felt like in some ways you're looking for an identity here? Mm. You're looking for the story of yourself.
Yeah.
As you travel, did you find it?
No, not in one place. There were places I went to where I felt St. John's always feels like home to me. Especially the Abbey Church. I find a deep sense of abiding peace when I get to the Abbey Church and I'm surrounded by the monks, the Order of St. Benedict. It's a very special place to me. But there are other places that I went, like the Lost 40. I was surprised at how...
That was interesting. Yeah.
The Lost 40, for your listeners, is something I didn't know about until about a year ago, but because of a mapping error in the 1800s, 1880, I think, there was a 40 of trees that they were never harvested by the lumberjacks. And these trees are 250 years old, and they tower into the sky. And it's deep in Minnesota. And I went there, and I was the only person in the Lost 40. And it was peaceful, and I was just aware of the passage of time. So I guess I found, I went to certain places, and I found, I guess, parts of what I was looking for, but I never found the totality, which is human, I think.
Right, yeah. Let's go to St. John's, because this is my favorite chapter. I just think it's an absolutely astonishing chapter. You wrote about it so beautifully, and I think everybody's going to want to go. Everybody with that sort of, point of view or sentiment of what exists at this place, including the St. John Bible, the original St. John Bible.
Yeah.
And I've seen the Heritage Version. I think it's called the Heritage Version at Dakota Wesleyan.
Yeah.
This is the original.
Yeah.
For folks who don't know what the St. John Bible is and how it came to Minnesota.
A fascinating story. Donald Jackson was the calligrapher for the Queen and for the House of Lords.
England,
Yes. And he'd always had a dream of doing a handwritten Bible. And the monks at St. John's, they are rooted in tradition that goes back 1,500 years, but they are forward-looking. And that's very clear with the Abbey Church. And it's also very clear with the Bible. So they like the idea of, we haven't had a handwritten Bible for 500 years. That's a good idea. Let's do that. And the St. John's Bible is often referred to as America's Book of Kells, because the Book of Kells is an illuminated manuscript that's housed in Trinity College Dublin in Ireland. And that's about 1,200 years old, and it's an illuminated gospel manuscript. And the St. John's Bible is just breathtaking. It's really gorgeous. And it's full of artwork, but it's not artwork that is designed to illustrate what's being talked about. It's artwork that's designed to provoke conversations.
Mm. How many times in your travels in Minnesota did you find a connection to Ireland?
I
That was interesting how often that was happening.
Yeah.
Which, you know, most people wouldn't make those connections.
Yeah, but I guess it's not a surprise that I did with my deep connections to Ireland. But it wasn't until I'd written, the third draft that I started to realize, wow, Ireland is popping up an awful lot here.
Yeah.
Because while I was in Duluth, I thought, well, Duluth is like a second city to the Twin Cities in much the same way that Belfast is a second city to Dublin. Yeah. Even that sense of the industrial nature of Duluth versus the hip and trendy kind of things that we see in the Twin Cities.
Yeah, yeah. And you do go to Bob Dylan's house,
childhood
home, take a walk down to the school, to the high school.
I do.
What's your deal with Dylan? Like, you don't... I'm like, what do you mean you don't? You're not like an all-in fan.
I don't dislike him. He doesn't... his music just hasn't clicked with me.
Because you're a Rush fan, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
We could waste the rest of the hour. Moving right along, yeah.
But to this point, I guess what I'm also trying to make is like the things that exist in, one of the greatest libraries in the world, some of the oldest fossils, the oldest site of recorded knowledge, Bob Dylan, NHL stars.
Yeah.
There's a lot, Mayo Clinic, the reinvention of so many things. Is coming from this place in the middle of America, which often I think gets overlooked.
Yeah, that sense of innovation is just, it's really central to Minnesota. Who knows, maybe it's the cold winters and people are stuck inside.
Yeah, some stuff to do, yeah.
Water skiing was invented, the jet ski. I mean, it's the Nerf footballs are invented in
Post-it
Minnesota.
Post-it note.
Yeah. Post-it note. I have a whole section in the book about all the things that were invented in Minnesota, including the synthetic rubber. Neil Armstrong's boot was invented by 3M.
In Minnesota, the Midwest.
Yeah.
So does the Midwest get the play that it should?
Nationally? In the rest,
nationally, for being this sort of center of innovation?
I don't think so. And this is a conversation I've had with a number of my writer friends in the Midwest. John Luck calls it the lost region, and I think he's right about that. Because if you're from the South, you're labeled a Southern writer, or the East Coast, or maybe you're a Southwest writer. But if you're a Midwest writer, that's hard to kind of quantify. And even Midwest writers that are seen as somehow the national voice for the United States, I'm thinking of Toni Morrison, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Hemingway, they become American writers, and their Midwesternness is really downplayed.
I don't think I knew Toni Morrison was from Minnesota.
No, she's not from Minnesota.
Oh,
no.
Where is she from?
Iowa? You're putting me on the spot here. You
know? I didn't think Toni Morrison was from Minnesota. But to that point, you have some really fun Fitzgerald stuff in there, too. Speculative, like, where would he have been? What would he have seen? I thought you did an interesting job of asking questions and finding answers, and then asking questions and not finding answers.
Yeah. I really appreciate that compliment because I had fun coming up with the questions.
Yeah.
And I would go to experts, and sometimes they would deflate me because I was like, oh, but I really wanted this to be true.
You're right.
And to the case in point of Fitzgerald, there was a rumor that he got the idea for The Great Gatsby from being in Stillwater.
Yeah.
And it's not true.
Yeah. So as a journalist, when I think about going and wanting to know something, there's almost like a drive or an obligation to find out. But I thought you also were working on that line between, here's so many things that I found out, here's so much information for you, but yet I'm also going to be okay just as a regular, traveler, as just a person, as a guy, saying, I don't know that.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be interesting to know? And then walking away.
Yeah. I wanted the reader to see me as not having all of the answers.
Yeah.
And, there are parts of the book where I maybe don't look as good as I could because of something I'm thinking or I make a mistake. And, I'm hardest, I think, on myself in that book. Anybody that appears in this book by name, they just were incredibly kind and helpful and they were experts. And I wanted to make sure they were put in the best light possible.
All right. For people who do not know about Princess K of the Milky Way, and the butter sculptures where they carve the likeness of contestants out of butter at the Minnesota State Fair. I did not know the butter queens get to take those home.
I didn't either. the amount of research I did for this book is kind of crazy.
At the end of the fair?
Oh, my goodness. And
your 900 pounds of butter goes home with you in a cooler?
That's right. And you have to figure out how to get it home. So I know one of the Princess K's of the Milky Way, I can't remember her name, she's got her head still in a deep freezer and has been there since the 1980s.
And other people have a big corn, you know, fry corn. Corn boil.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they just make sweet corn.
Yeah, or the Christmas cookies for the next several years, you know. But it is a really weird tradition that the Minnesota State Fair has. I mean, I was at the State Fair not that long ago, and of course I saw the butterheads, because have you even done the State Fair if you don't see the butterheads?
You got to go to the dairy barn.
Yeah, it's a deeply weird tradition. And when I was living in Europe and I told my friends about this, they just would look at me like, this is crazy.
What? Yes. So you're at the State Fair. And you're with your sister, and you go down the slide. So I feel like when you know, we've said a couple times that it's funny and it's self-depreciating. Patrick Hicks, PhD, on the giant slide with the felt mat.
Yeah. If you haven't done the giant slide at the Minnesota State Fair, I'm here to tell you that it is much, much faster than it looks. I honest to God thought I was going to run into people at the end.
See, when you become an adult and you accumulate mass, like when you're 8, you're light. So it might be fast, but it's not super fast.
If you're
grown up.
I have some mass. I have some pounds.
You can get some.
I thought I was going to take out people.
You can get airborne on the slide.
I swear to God, okay. I did. Yes.
How has this, and I guess the point that I'm trying to make is, like, you know, I've interviewed you since I came here. Actually, before I came here, I was interviewing you for print about the work that you're doing. And this is the most fun we've ever had in an interview, because so many, although there are serious topics in this book, for sure, it is also up against, you know, buckets of cookies that spill and, you know, just delightful little romps into areas that, you know, you had a good time.
I did. I had so much fun writing this book.
Yeah.
It was a joy. And I think the reader will finish this book and feel like they've traveled Minnesota with me. Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping it's laugh out loud funny. People have told me in parts it is. And it's just a different side of my personality that hasn't been seen in the public, because when you're writing about something like the Holocaust, I have to treat it with the gravity and seriousness that it demands.
Right. So what's your advice to yourself as a future writer? More fun, more lightness? Like, how did that help to sort of reset you for sort of, you know, the scholarship that you do all the time? Or did this open a pathway for you to say, you know, it is okay to also be in the world writing?
It's the latter.
For delight.
It's the latter. And I'm pleased you brought this up, because I never would have seen myself as a travel writer that uses humor. Mm-hmm. But I kind of love it. I can see more books like this.
Yeah. Lots of interviews in Minnesota so far?
Oh, for the book tour?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yes. And I don't want to say where they are right now, because it's the beginning of the book tour and people are reaching out, but I haven't nailed down media interviews just yet.
All right.
But I anticipate that this fall semester is going to be very, very busy for me on the road.
I would just like to point out that here in South Dakota at SDPB, we're giving you a nice.
It's very good.
You're still a South Dakotan.
I'm still a South Dakotan.
Patrick Hicks.
Yes.
It's okay. You can be more than one thing at once.
So thank you, STBB, for giving me the space to talk about Minnesota.
That's Patrick Hicks. The latest book is called Greater Minnesota. And that is our show for today. We hope that it served you. In the Moment is produced by Ari Youngeman and Ellen Kester. I'm your host, Lori Walsh, from all of us here at SDPB. Thank you for listening.